From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Rochester when a mother signed her two daughters up for daycare. Brandy Johnson is a social worker, and she says both in her work and in her role as a parent, she's been able to see the role that childcare plays for kids and families. Johnson's daughters were 18 months and 3 months old when she signed them up. She says because of that resource, she has watched their social skills expand profoundly. But Johnson also says the cost of care has forced her to make sacrifices, the biggest one being time. She told the Children's Agenda, quote, "I've had to take on more work hours to cover both childcare and home expenses. Families deserve access to resources and for information to be accessible across the state, not county by county," end quote. Johnson shared that perspective with the Children's Agenda as part of its announcement of a new report. The document titled Barriers to Care, Improving Access to New York State's Child Care Assistance Program, focuses on Johnson's latter point, that information about child care is not easily accessible. The report states that of the 58 counties outside of New York City, more than half of county websites did not include any of the elements deemed essential by the Children's Agenda. Those include standardized information about child care, an online child care assistance application, and funding child care assistance navigation services. People have no idea what's out there. The result? Well, families remain underserved, depending on where they live. And New York has a surplus of child care funds. In fact, the report states that enrollment in child care assistance programs statewide has declined over the past 10 years. Better access to child care information means more parents can remain in the workforce, the economy can grow, and the labor force can expand. Plus, perhaps most importantly, children get the best possible start to life and consistent care. This hour, we discuss the report, its recommendations, and what all of this means for children and families in New York. And this comes at a time when New York State, its leadership, even on the Democratic side, is debating how much do we invest in this? What are the new ideas we invest in? What's already working and what's not? Let's talk about that. The policy director for the Children's Agenda is Pete Nabosny. Pete, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Danielle Jones is on the line with us, a mother and a member of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative Experience Cohort, a licensed mental health counselor and podcaster. Danielle, welcome. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate you being here to share your story and your perspective. Let me just briefly start with a couple of points for Pete. This is a week that whenever the governor's budget rolls out, it's usually about school funding. It's usually the governor comes up with a number, the legislature says it's not enough, and they fight, okay, they debate, they negotiate, they end up in the middle. This year, the governor for school funding has said, let's put the biggest number out there we've ever done, but on child care, Democrats in the legislature have said, we want $5 billion, and we've got specific ideas on what we can do here. And the governor, Governor Hochul, said $1 billion. It's a huge gap. So just starting there, from your perspective, is that a fillable gap, and what does that tell you about what's going on in Albany?
Well, I certainly hope it's fillable, because the needs of families for child care throughout the state have really never been greater. Child care is as expensive as it's ever been. It's getting more expensive. We see, you know, rising wages all throughout our economy, and that's great for workers, and it's great for all sorts of people, but it's a challenge for parents who have to bear the cost of those higher wages for their child care workers. And we see a real, you know, a drag on economic recovery, because our child care sector hasn't recovered from the pandemic. Employment's still down. There's still closed classrooms. We're still really struggling. And so we do need to see a substantial investment in child care this year. And we're hoping that the governor and the legislature can get closer to that higher number rather than the governor's opening bid.
Are there specific ideas that you've heard from legislators that you like? I mean, we've talked a little bit about this, but it's not that there's competing ideas. There's different ideas on how to pay for things and ideas that are out there. I mean, are there certain things that you look at and say, I'm surprised Governor Hochul didn't immediately jump on board with XYZ?
Yeah, so I think her proposal, it includes some of the components that I would like to see, and I think a lot of other advocates and certainly lawmakers would like to see.
For example?
So there's two things you really need to tackle in child care.
Yeah.
One is you need to extend eligibility to more people for assistance, so that right now, if you make more than $53,000 a year, a family of four, you get no assistance. But if you have an infant and care costs $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 for that child, if you're making $58,000 a year. You can't possibly afford to put your child in a child care center. So we need to expand eligibility to more people, to certainly to more middle-income households. And we need to raise worker pay so that we have the staff who can, you know, who can staff those classrooms and provide that care that kids need. So we need to do something both on increasing eligibility, and then we need to do something on worker compensation. And we need to do it with state dollars, because child care workers are basically paid the lowest of any kind of field in our community,
yeah,
as they are throughout the state. And the only way for them to get wage increases, which they need, for someone to pay more. And it's really hard to ask, you know, working parents who have, you know, loans and mortgages and other things to pay an additional $5,000 a year for their kids' care in order to bump those wages. So we need to do something both on the compensation side and on the eligibility for assistance side.
And briefly on the compensation, which it's amazing that for many listeners who've called the program and emailed in recent months as we've talked about this issue, that child care is so expensive for families, and yet child care workers are paid so low.
Yeah.
But it's true. But if you try to address that, say, with federal dollars, you don't know consistently what you're getting. It's got to be sort of a permanent state-level solution, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we could start. We do have some federal dollars left over from all the COVID relief.
Yeah, and we'll
bills.
Talk about that coming
we
up.
We could use those, but that's not a sustainable solution.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's been a tremendous amount of money that has gone to the child care sector to stabilize it over the past few months, and it has helped. But if you talk to center directors, you talk to people who run a small group family child care program, they say, I can offer hiring and retention bonuses to staff, but I can't invest in permanent wage increases when the money that we're getting from the federal government through the state, it dries up after, you know, right now, basically. So
yeah.
So we need sustained wage increases. We need sustained raises for these workers. And so we need state dollars to be committed to that task.
From your report, what was the part of the report that, if anything sticks with listeners, what do you want them to understand about what the Children's Agenda has been reporting on here?
So I'd like to say a few things. One,
the whole report.
Sure, I'll walk
the
through
whole thing.
You know, every page here. No, but I think the key findings for a lot of people will be the fact that fewer people are receiving assistance throughout New York State than they were 10 years ago by substantial amounts. And the pandemic has accelerated that, but there was a trend that predated the pandemic that fewer and fewer families were getting help affording care. The other, I think, big finding is that counties have a lot of money that's sitting in their accounts right now that could be out there helping families. There's a lot that goes into that. A lot of it is restrictive state policies. The state needs to allow counties to serve more people, which I know is something Monroe County has been seeking, you know, permission to do. But what this report really focuses on, a piece that I think we don't talk a lot about, we talk a lot about eligibility levels and are we going to pay for this or that or who gets covered or how are we going to do a worker compensation fund. But what a lot of this report really tries to focus in on is that the administration of how we deliver services to people, particularly child care assistance, is like woefully inadequate for the year 2022. There's no online application anywhere in New York State to fill out, you know, to seek assistance. There's no real navigation services out there. You think back to when the Affordable Care Act was passed, you had massive investments in helping people sign up for health insurance and navigators throughout the state. There's none of that for child care. And the state really delegates the administration of the child care program to the various counties, the social service districts, all the counties plus New York City. And it directs people, well, if you want more information about whether you qualify, what eligibility criteria there are in that county, go to that county website. Well, the Children's Agenda, we went to all those county websites and we found very little information in most places. Some are better than others, but if you want, you know, some basic information, like does my income qualify me? Maybe you're in school and you work part-time. Is that allowed for child care subsidy? What does the application look like? What materials do I need to bring with me to an appointment at the DSS building? In the majority of the state, the majority of counties in the state, you can't find any of that information. And that's really not serving families well. People look for information online to learn about whether they qualify for programs. That's how people access information now. And in New York State, we just don't make that information available.
Why? What is the excuse for this?
So I think historically, there was a real scarcity of child care funds. under the previous governor, there wasn't really a commitment to investing more in childcare. Counties were trying to avoid having wait lists, having people applying for assistance, being told there's no funding. And so I think there was this understandable but unfortunate impulse to not really try to market the program. If you walk around in Rochester right now, you can see on the side of buses, you see sign up for pre-K. We want people to enroll in pre-K. That's a goal of our community. You don't see any signs for, like, sign up for childcare subsidies, get help of paying for the cost of care, because there's been a scarcity of funds. And, you know, I think there hasn't been that effort to advertise. And the paradigm is shifting. I think there's a desire to make it a goal of New York to have more families on assistance. But our public communication messaging hasn't followed that. And that's why we released this report. We're hoping to see that change.
Well, let me shift and ask Danielle about some of her experience. And first of all, Danielle, your resume is fascinating. Why don't you tell listeners a little bit more about who you are?
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. But everything I do is just out of me being a person who likes to support and serve. But I actually just launched a business in 2020, Danielle Larice Enterprises, where I provide mental health counseling with a specialty in maternal mental health. And I'm also a birth and postpartum doula, and I host a podcast for moms. So everything that I do is just to support moms in the community of Rochester. So I'm excited to be here today.
Podcast is called Mom Me, M-O-M, and then M-E,
yes.
Mom Me.
Mommy Timeout, that's right. The podcast is really about encouraging moms to take time for themselves, but also knowing that you can, develop yourself as a mother, but also you're still a woman at the end of the day. So my podcast is just to help moms navigate that space between motherhood and womanhood, because it gets a little messy right in between those two roles.
What is your own experience as a mom?
So I have a son. He's 7. I just had my daughter. She's 2 months. So I'm a mom of 2. My experience as a mom has been very up and down. I think motherhood or parenthood in general is just a very complex role to have. There's so many different things that you're trying to navigate. And one of the things is childcare, which I know we're here to talk about today, but that has been a challenge for me, even going back to 7 years when I was trying to get childcare for my son. And now I'm working through that process for my daughter at this point as I'm getting ready to go back to work.
And tell me a little bit about, the efforts that you have to make sure that if you're going to go back to work, what's the childcare situation? Do you know what's available? How has that gone for you?
So I would say now, because I've already been through the experience, it has been a little bit easier for me because of going through the experience with my son. So right now I'm more familiar about what resources are out there. So I know exactly who to contact to get the information that I need. Also, when it comes to finding a childcare facility, because I was already connected with a daycare with my son, that is the person that I'm planning to return to. So now for me, because I went through that experience, it's been easier. But when I was going through it with my son, it was very hard. I felt like I did not know much about the information that was out there. I only knew to go through DHS. But even when I went through them, I was immediately told that I made too much money. And for me, that was frustrating because I felt like I'm just barely making it, right? So what do you mean too much money? Like, what are these income guidelines? And then also just knowing what daycares are out there, like, where can I go to learn more about daycares? It was hard for me when I went through that with my son.
I'm going to come back to this point with Danielle in a second. Let me just ask Pete Nabosny about what Danielle is talking about. Sometimes we call it a benefits cliff, an earnings penalty. Is it inevitable that there always will be some benefits cliff? Are there better policy ways to deal with that? Because what Danielle is describing there, finding out technically you make too much money to qualify for this, when she's sitting there going, you got to be kidding me. She is not alone. A lot of people have gone through that. Is that inevitable that there is some sort of cliff?
Well, I've talked about this a few times, right? That you could embrace sort of a more of a universal approach to these programs. If you say we're going to cover everybody, and whether that's it's free for everybody, or we have some kind of sliding scale. That's a way to sort of, you know, where as you make more money, you pay an additional amount. But that's, there are ways that we can construct programs like that that avoid penalizing people for making a little bit more than the eligibility level, or for taking a raise or taking on additional hours. In New York right now, because childcare is so expensive, and if you qualify for assistance, you get a really substantial benefit, it's an enormous cliff. I mean, if you go from being just below, you know, if you're making $50,000 a year, childcare in Monroe County is extremely affordable. You're paying, you know, a couple thousand dollars per year to paying full freight. And if you have a couple kids and you're making that $53,000, $54,000, and you have to pay $25,000 a year, like, that's unaffordable now. You can't make that. So there are ways to design programs so you cover more people, so you have things phase out. But childcare in New York does not take that structure. And so you're either in or you're out. And if you make slightly above a certain amount, you're really penalized. And so there's a real incentive to, like, not take that raise.
Absolutely.
To not add hours, not to not generate more earned income. And that's really frustrating for people. And it's really counterproductive for us as a society.
How are we in 2022 not on at least some kind of a sliding scale? Because what Pete's describing here, obviously, if you don't want a means test at all and everybody's eligible and you make something universal, well, then there is no cliff. Means testing makes some sense to me. I don't, as a policy maker and someone who likes UBI, maybe it doesn't make as much sense to you. But what do you think, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, if you have scarce resources, you want to see those resources go towards the people most in need. And that's, like, you know, I think that makes complete sense. But we've done this thing, particularly with childcare, where we've said, you know, everyone below this point gets it, and everyone above this point doesn't get it. And that's, you know, a dollar of additional earning doesn't mean you don't need that help. And you know, people are right in that zone there. And so it's really poor program design, and we need to get away from it.
Yeah, it's got to be on more of a sliding scale, like Pete says here. And so, Danielle, can you describe what that's like when you're told, do you technically make too much to qualify for a benefit? What are some of the decisions that you start thinking about? Like, you know, what do you do about that?
Yeah, so when I was told that, it was very frustrating. And I say that because I remember I asked the lady of this particular program that I was trying to get assistance from, like, what is the max that I can make? And she said something between, like, $16,000 and $18,000 a year. And in my head, I'm like, that makes no sense. Like, how can I even survive off of that, right? And she went on to tell me, like, you know, it's based on the cost of living. And to hear that with these income guidelines, my opinion is, you know, that's not the cost of living. These numbers are based on the cost of surviving, right? Like, that's basically what you can do with these numbers that they have. Like, if we're really going to say it's the cost of living, it needs to be raised, because we're thinking about the quality of life here, right? I don't want to have to make this number that you guys have and then just barely be making it all the time. At what point do we help families move out of that vicious space, right? Out of that cycle. Because as soon as I make more money, then you're going to increase the amount that I have to put towards my childcare. So really, I'm always going to be in this uncomfortable space financially, right? But with that experience, like, it was frustrating, because I knew of other, like, parents that were able to get assistance from this program, but these parents were not even working. So I felt frustrated, because I'm like, they're getting daycare assistance. They can send their kids to daycare every day. They're not working, but I'm actually trying to, like, work and provide for my family, and I can't get any help out here. Like, I felt like I had nowhere to turn.
Yeah, and, you know, Pete, you talk to policymakers about any number of issues, some of them very complex, and this one seems so straightforward. I mean, if you talk to a state legislator or whoever is in charge of these kind of, shouldn't this be obvious? The second you point this out, what Danielle and other people are going through, don't policymakers usually say, well, that makes no sense. We're not going to do that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they often say it makes no sense, but then we haven't had the political will to change it yet. And I think you could draw some conclusions about, you know, why. I think this is, the cost of not having childcare has been borne primarily by women, and that's not as valued in society and hasn't been as valued among policymakers writ large. You know, I think there's a connection that a lot of people have in their head around child care assistance and welfare programs, or what they perceive as welfare programs. And there's, you know, a negative stigma around some of those programs out there that, you know, influence some people's thinking. But I think broadly people agree that the current situation doesn't make sense. It's counterproductive. It's harmful for kids. It's harmful for the economy. But we've yet to kind of see the stars align. We're hoping this is the year. There seems to be an unprecedented amount of attention to childcare within the legislature, particularly this year. And the governor, despite, you know, releasing a proposal that we don't think is enough, it's still a lot grander than her predecessor ever introduced. And we're hoping that she has spoken a lot about her own challenges finding childcare when she was an aide to then Senator Moynihan. And we're hoping that what comes out in the final budget is something that really starts to address the child care needs that families have.
So in a moment, we're going to kind of work through some of the other issues that face parents like Danielle, highlighted by the Children's Agenda. And we're going to try to at least address some of these questions about unused child care funds, which is a shocking phrase to even say that exists. But we'll talk about that and why that's happening. Before that, let me grab a phone call. It's Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Just fine. How are you?
Well, great. I'm pretty good. You know, I had the chance to go to school in France as a preschooler way back in the day. And they had what, I don't know what we would call it now, but my father had to take me someplace. I don't know where we went, but for me to wait at a child care center, I don't know what we called it, preschool or whatever, and we'd have school there. And then when the bus came to take us to Nancy, where first grade was, then I would have that also. But they were just really very generous with the military. I guess the military paid for all that, but we had such complete caretaking in the early morning till school started. And I just wondered if we could compare what we're thinking about doing to what Canada and France are offering and how they go about that. I know that France and probably Canada, too, have extensive maternity leave. And then you would have the caretaking during the day. But Michael Moore did a real good coverage of that when he produced Sicko. I don't know if you remember that, but all the things that they offered in France. I want to ask, too, in addition to comparing it to other countries, they frequently asked corporate entities to provide child care in some of these countries. And I know we talked about that back a few years ago, and I wonder what happened to that. So if you could talk about that a little bit, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
okay.
Jane. Yeah,
okay.
Thank you very much. On the subject of other countries first, Pete Nabosny. She's asking about everything from maternity leave to just whole other models here. What do you see?
Yeah, I mean, most other wealthy nations, developed nations have, let's say, a broader array of early childhood
more
supports
robust.
For families. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at particularly like Northern European countries, but also increasingly Canada has really been investing a lot in recent years. They have, you know, more generous paid leave. We do have paid leave in New York State. We're one of a few states that has that, but we've got it. But it's not nearly as robust as what you see in most of Europe. They have, you know, something approaching a child allowance in most of these places so that families get support for financially for having those children with them. And then they have, you know, whether it's fully universal, free at the point of access, or a small fee childcare, that's sort of the standard in a lot of other countries. And a lot of those, particularly Scandinavian countries, also, if a parent chooses to stay home with that child during those early years, they'll increase kind of the amount you know, that family receives through their child allowance. So it's kind of honoring the different caretaking choices that families have. In the United States, we don't have anything approaching that. We did have for that 6-month period, a monthly child tax credit, which is hopefully going to come back, but we're not, we're not getting that right now. We do have 12 weeks of paid leave in New York State, unlike a lot of other states. And we have a child care assistance program that is extremely limited in terms of who it serves, and has lots of of rules and reasons why people get excluded. So we don't have the same kind of comprehensive approach to supporting families with young children that a lot of other, wealthier developed countries have.
And on the corporate side, she says, she's heard about countries where there's more of corporate support for childcare. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we do have some of that in the U.S. too. I mean, some particularly larger employers, U of R, RIT, MCC, they have childcare on site that they give discounts around to employees. It's not free by any means. Corning Glass down in Corning has a pretty robust kind of contracted childcare program to help them draw workers. So examples exist. It's not nearly as kind of widespread, but I also think it's extremely difficult for small employers. If you own a business that has 15, 20 employees, you don't have the scale of the resources to offer that kind of support to your employees. So it might be something that larger employers, particularly with more well-paid staff, can afford to offer as a benefit, but it doesn't address the kind of broad social need that we have around childcare assistance.
And you write up the monthly checks, $250 for kids over six, $300 for kids under, if I'm remembering right?
Correct.
That just ran out.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of talk that this would be a popular program, it would come back. And then I see a headline in the New York Times, why the Biden child tax credit wasn't all that popular. It wasn't? I mean, everybody likes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the families that got it appreciated it quite a bit.
What happened there? Why do you think that it has not been renewed?
So I think there's a lot. I mean, one of the specific reasons that Senator Manchin didn't like the fact that the benefit went to families regardless of whether or not they had sort of earned income.
Yep.
And so that seems to be a sticking point that's held up a lot of the Build Back Better negotiations. It takes 50 votes plus the vice president to pass something. So if no Republican senators were in favor of that package. So if one person objects, it's not going to continue. I think some of the polling I saw around it indicated that families that received the credit and the benefit valued it really highly, including, a range of, Republican, independent, Democratic voters really supported it. But there's a lot of people who don't have children in our society. And I think some of the polling showed that those folks who were not receiving it because they don't have, children in the home were maybe okay with it as a short-term measure during the pandemic, but didn't want to see it made permanent. And so, I think the voting interests and the stated interests of families who are receiving this credit were, a bit outweighed on the margins by some things here.
Yeah, President Manchin President Biden. Wow, that is an interesting Freudian slip. I was going to say, President Biden has said they're going to work on bringing back and making permanent that credit. Maybe President Manchin is the proper term. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see.
Anyway, so let me turn back to Danielle, because I think there's a point that for families with one child, I'm thinking maybe people have some insight in this too. But Danielle, you just had your second child 2 months ago. And what you've told us is that your experience in dealing with a system where there's not a whole lot of good information available, that helped you prepare for what to do when you had your second child, but that put you behind in dealing with care for perhaps for your son because you didn't know about what's available. And the information is pretty opaque. So now you've got at least a better sense on what to do. But for families who aren't having multiple kids or maybe haven't navigated the way you have, I'm thinking about a lot of single child households or just families who don't sort of figure out the system that you have. I don't know if they'll ever get the help. I mean, just because you're eligible doesn't mean you automatically will get something. And I think that's hard for people to understand.
Right. And I think that speaks to the accessibility of the information, right? So when I applied through DHS, I was just denied. And I wasn't told there's other resources out there, but I learned of, I think it's called Workforce Development Institute, where they provide some childcare assistance for working parents. I knew nothing about that. Like DHS, when they denied me, they never said, oh, but maybe you can try this. I found out about that program through my nurse that was coming to the house to visit me and my son every couple of weeks. So she was a resource that provided extra information about that. So for a small period of time, I was able to get some assistance through that program, but I would have never known about that if my nurse didn't tell me. I had never heard of it. But also with that, I know Pete mentioned just with the information being available, like making it more available. When we see, like he said, on the side of these buses, we see different things. Or I'm always getting like little postcards in the mail about different things, like doing things like that, sending the information out to the families in the city, like in Monroe County, to let them know what's available. I feel like money should be spent on that, you know, advertising these resources that are out there.
Well, and this is where the Children's Agenda did really outstanding work in their Barriers to Care report. Because sure, you can use the side of a bus, or you can hope that a nurse is going to relay information like Danielle's did. Thank goodness for that. But it's got to start with comprehensive online access. I mean, people are online. People live online. It's essentially a utility now. And so here's some of what the Children's Agenda highlighted. Suffolk County doing it really, really well. That's an example of a county that is communicating information about their child care assistance program in a really comprehensive way. Their website basically hit all the buttons that you wanted it to press. It had information on parent co-pays, applicant rights and responsibilities, a child care eligibility wizard. Great stuff. Erie County, not far from us, their website, social service website, had a wealth of information about eligibility requirements for families and detailed guidance about how to apply. But it's not just the big counties. You said Yates County, one of the smallest counties in the state, did a very good job overall. So if they're doing it well in Yates County and Erie County and Suffolk County, let's just give a quick grade. How'd Monroe County do?
So we had more information available than most, but we did not kind of check all the boxes that we were looking for. Nowhere on the Monroe County website can you find, you know, for example, a table that says, how many people are there in your household? Do you make, you know, below this level or between this level and this level?
An eligibility wizard, so to speak.
Yeah, and so someone who's, again, we started this by saying, you know, we did a Google search, like get help paying for child care in New York State. And it takes you to the state OCFS, Office of Children and Family Services website. And then the state says, well, you want more information, go to a county website. And here's a map of the counties, find your county.
Yeah.
And but then, you know, there's nothing beyond that at the state level, which is really disappointing. And then, you know, Monroe County, again, it does have some information available. And there is an application available there that you could download and figure out what you need to have. But we could, as a county, be doing a lot more, both on that website and through other sources, to make more people aware of whether or not the information is, you know, that they have the sort of personal circumstances of their life. And that's, you know, I think that's excluding a lot of people, because there's some percentage of people who aren't going to go to the DHS building and make an appointment and find out whether or not they're eligible, or they're going to assume that they're not eligible because of some reason. And the county has done a lot of work actually over the past couple of years to increase the number of families who are eligible. They've lowered co-pays. They've started paying providers for absences, which induces more providers to maybe accept subsidy. They've raised eligibility levels on their own before the state sort of required them to. So the situation in Monroe County is different now than it was, you know, maybe 7 years ago. But if a family has had a past experience where they didn't qualify, they may assume that they don't qualify now. So we need to do a better job sort of marketing and making more information available about the program.
Well, sometimes the people who run social services, et cetera, they don't change every time there's a new political administration in charge. It's not always political jobs, but I do wonder if the Bellow administration understands that the county website, despite the efforts of the county to improve eligibility, to make some of the changes you just highlighted, the website is poorly communicating this and hurting people. Do they know that?
I mean, I've shared some things with them at times. I think, you know, that there's certainly a lot of work that could be done on our county website to, you know, I'm not a webmaster, but I think the county website overall could use a little bit of an overhaul in terms of how it shares information in general. But yeah, I think that it is, there's a policy side of things, and then there's a, communication side of things, and then there's a, you know, how do we reduce the burdens on families to access care? Because, you know, hearing about what Danielle said about eligibility level 7 years ago, I think that was the case 7 years ago, that they were, the county did not put a lot of kind of our own dollars into the child care subsidy system. We weren't receiving the amount of state resources that we get now. And so the eligibility at that time may have just been for very low-income families, families that were on public assistance. But that has changed, and because those things have changed, we need to do a better job communicating to families throughout the community that that things have changed and that they should seek out help if they think they may possibly qualify.
Danielle, what do you need most as a mother of a 7-year-old boy, a 2-month-old daughter? What do you need most?
How much time I got to list this? So I guess
you got plenty of time. It's yours.
So I want to say, like, in terms of child care, right, what I need most is just having a safe space for my children to go, right? Having a place where my mind, like, I'm not going to be anxious about it. I could be or have a peace of mind while my children are there, right? And I need support with being able to pay for these costs because with two kids, it's a lot. But I need that support with being able to pay for the daycare. And like I said, that's something I'm working through now, is trying to see if I can get some assistance with paying for daycare, especially for my young one. Like, she's going to be there all day, right? My son goes to school, so his care mostly is like after school kind of a thing. So, yeah, I would say that's what I need. I would say I need most right now in terms of daycare.
How are your kids doing?
Oh, my kids are doing awesome. I pride myself on being able to say I'm a good mom, and I really pour a lot into my kids. And just speaking of that, I will say, like, one of the things that I did experience with my son when dealing with, like, the cost of childcare was just I felt like I had to sacrifice time with him. I had to sacrifice being able to get him into like into different enrichment activities or experiences. And what I mean by that is, at one point I picked up a part-time job that I could work like on the evenings or the weekends when I knew that like my family would be able to help out more with him. So I picked up more hours to be able to pay for like daycare and home expenses, which just doesn't make sense because I'm picking up more hours to work, which would then make me need more daycare. And so when I think about it like that, it's like, you know, like let's make this make sense at the end of the day, right? It's a vicious cycle that unfortunately many parents are put in. But also when it came to finances, like I had to decide, like, you know, my son wanted to do sports and he wanted to try music lessons and stuff like that. But some things I just could not afford to pay for. Mm-hmm. And so in my eyes, like, you know, it wasn't fair that I'm choosing between childcare and maybe giving my son an experience of learning to play the piano or something like that, right? And it's just, that is a struggle as a parent. I know that was a struggle for me, but even with the moms that I serve, like, that's a struggle as a parent to have to choose between giving your children experiences that you would like them to have because of the cost of childcare and other expenses.
And when you think about having a son now who's 7, a newborn daughter, and you think about their futures and everything that you want them to have access to, childcare, as you said, the chance to try new things and to experience, whether it's sports, arts, et cetera, and you think about your own career that you want to build for yourself, what worries you most right now about, you know, what you can and can't do, Danielle?
I would say my biggest worry right now, and it's funny you asked me, I was just having this conversation yesterday, but it's time with my kids, honestly, because I feel like I have to, the life that I want to give them, I need to work. I need to work so many hours just to be able to give them the life that I want them to have, the life that I feel like my children deserve. Right. And so that does leave me sacrificing time with them. So I would say that's my biggest concern, is I want my kids to see me as a parent that was present and there for important activities, sports and things like that. I want my kids to see me as a parent that was present and not someone that just was working all the time just to make sure they had what they need and wanted.
Pete, how common is that concern?
Well, I think that's a fairly universal concern. Like, I'm a parent as well with two young children, and you know, you want to spend as much time with your kids as you can to share experience with them and to help them grow into the, you know, the people you that they can be. And I think that some of the challenges around not just childcare, but a lot of these broader policies or lack of policies we have in certain areas is that, you know, our economy, our society is really geared up for, you know, parents needing to work as much as possible to provide for their family, to support their kids, particularly if they're, you know, they don't have really high wages and you know, high salary jobs. And so the idea that you need to work more and take on additional hours to pay for childcare, to spend more time away from your children is, you know, it's really terrible. It's really, you know, it's heartbreaking to think about, because, you know, parents want to spend time with their children. Children want to spend time with their parents, and kids do need childcare. And we need to make sure that they, you know, they have childcare available and that it can be affordable. But the idea, because it's so unaffordable, that you need to spend less time with your kids so that you can, you know, make that childcare payment at the end of the week, is not benefiting kids. It's not benefiting parents. It's not benefiting us broadly as a society. And so, by extending, making these programs more available to more people, we're actually, like, by providing this work support, we're actually creating the space for parents and kids, for families to come together and to have those experiences. And so the absence of that is really harmful.
Let me grab a phone call from Michelle in Rochester. Hi, Michelle. Thanks for calling.
Hi,
go
Evan.
Ahead.
Yep. I was just calling in reference to the comment about the websites and everything. A lot of the websites, like even if you go to the Medicare website, it's really hard to understand some of the lingo, and trying to navigate on county websites, state websites and stuff, sometimes the interfaces are very confusing, and it's trying to find certain information is like looking a needle in a haystack.
So do you get the sense that they're just poorly designed, Michelle, or do you agree? I got an email from a listener who said they may be designing them so that people can't know what's available, so government spends less money on these kinds of services. That's kind of a dark view of it, but I know it's frustrating, Michelle.
Sometimes it seems like when you're given a benefit, whether it's medical benefits or insurance, it almost does seem like it's purposely made difficult for you, to discourage you from using the benefit. And it's almost as if you're being penalized for using it. Just like if you claim something on your homeowner's insurance, your insurance sometimes will go up because you utilize that benefit, but you're paying monthly for that benefit.
And it's also difficult to not only navigate a website and figure out maybe it's childcare benefits or whatever is out there, but it's difficult to get anybody on the phone anymore. You can't talk to
Correct.
Anybody. So you're on this island where it's like, figure it out. Is there anybody to call? Not really. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michelle.
And that's definitely true. And a lot of times you spend all this extra time trying to ask a question or figure something out on a benefit, yet most, you know, a lot of people are trying to work or take care of a family member or something, and that's taking away that person's time. And I feel like we should be able to then charge someone for us wasting our time to have to do that. I mean, it's a lot of wasteful time,
you know,
trying to navigate. And things like Medicare, they make the verbiage so difficult on the websites for people to understand. And most people can't understand the lingo that they use. And it would be nice to have stuff immediately more user-friendly and also simplified in basic layman's terms.
Yeah, absolutely. Better mm-hmm. websites and more human beings to talk to. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you for that insight. Let me let Pete and Danielle jump in that. Go ahead, Pete Nabosny.
Yeah, so I think that's a really great point, Michelle. And there's some research around this, around the whole concept of like administrative burdens that are placed to sort of maybe limit the the uptake in certain areas, and that's both a program design element. I mean, as a brief example, in the 1930s, we set up this thing called Social Security in the United States, right? And it took this massive effort in the pre-computer era to set up Social Security. Every person in the country had to get a number associated with it. Every new baby born had to get a number associated with it. But because we set that up, we then calculated over the course of someone's entire life their earnings. And so then when they reach a certain age, the government says, here's what you're entitled to in terms of a old age pension program. And that person that's been tracked their entire time, and Social Security participation is, nearly 100% in this country because of the program design, because it was designed to capture all that information, to track someone's earnings, and then deliver that benefit. And then you compare that to something like our child care subsidy program, where you have to prove all of your earning information. You have to provide pay stubs. You have to provide work hours. You have to fill out all this paperwork. Well, the state already, employers report payroll. I mean, there's a lot of information that's out there, but it's not structured in a way to help families. Instead, you have to really labor to access that benefit. I think we're seeing mm-hmm. a really similar example right now with all the COVID test stuff. The fact that there was a mandate for insurance companies to provide reimbursement for tests if you have the receipt, and maybe you have to keep the box that you have the test with, and then you have to fill out a multiple page form in order to get, $20, $30 of reimbursement for this test. That's another example of kind of setting up an administrative structure that is designed to limit participation. Because while these insurance companies have now been told that they have to reimburse it, and they will if you jump through, 250 hoops, that contrasts a lot with what we're also seeing right now, which is the updated effort after there was a lot of uproar of just like, go to this U.S. Postal Service website, put in your address, put in your name. That process
isn't
perfect.
And we'll send you four tests.
But we'll send you four tests. That covers mm-hmm. about 90% of American households have four or fewer people. So
absolutely.
It's not perfect, but it's a lot simpler, and it's set up in a way that actually is designed to get the benefit to people.
At least, though, Pete, the uproar and the mocking of this notion of insurance covering your rapid test, just keep the box, mm-hmm. at least that worked.
But
there was a political cost to doing something that sort of ham-fistedly. But, do you get the sense, Danielle? I mean, do you feel like these programs are set up in ways to limit the number of people who even know about them and use them intentionally, mm-hmm. or is this just bad design?
I think it's... I think it is bad design, and I say that because the process of applying is very overwhelming. So as Michelle was talking, I was over here nodding my head really hard because I agree with a lot of what she was saying, right? It takes a lot of time to do it, but if you're working all these hours, when do you find the time to be able to sit down and call and ask for the information that you need, right? By the time you realize that you wanted to make this phone call, it's like 6-7 at night. Offices are closed,
yeah,
right?
There's nobody to answer the phone.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then you make a plan for the next day, but who knows? The same thing happens again. You're working so much, taking care of the kids, you forget about it. So if there's an online option to be able to like submit the application, that's so much better because most of the time as parents, we're up later, right? I know me, sometimes I'm up at 3:30 in the morning just on the internet doing whatever I could get done, right? So I could be doing the application for that instead of trying to call someone during the day when I'm working and, I'm super busy. But also the other piece is just with the documents, all the documents you have to send in and just navigating that information, having like some support around that. So I remember with like the insurance, when you were signing up for insurance through like the New York State Marketplace or something like that, there were like navigators, I think they were called, that was able to help you with that. So having something similar like that for moms, or let me say parents, for parents to help them with signing up for some of these services that are out there to support them with childcare, I think that will be helpful because it can be very overwhelming. And then if you're thinking about a mom or a dad that's already overwhelmed with their lifestyle, just trying to take care of kids and work, and adding this on top of it, it can be a lot. So just the same way we did the insurance thing, I think having a system like that would be great. The last thing I want to say is, I know you mentioned about like having someone to talk to, right? Being able to call and get this information. That's another piece that needs to be worked on. And I'm just going to say that because sometimes you'll talk to someone and they can be very rude and nasty with some of these, in some of these systems. And it makes you feel like they can make you feel less than just because you're asking for some assistance or trying to get information about getting support. And that's not fair for our parents that need this help.
Absolutely, Danielle. I mean, I'm like one of the most privileged people who's ever lived, and I had to call the state DMV last week to approximate the pleasure of having to call the DMV. Pick up a hammer and hit yourself in the knee as hard as you can. It's roughly the same. It's just great. Real briefly here, Lisa writes and says, child care cliff, why wouldn't we adopt a system more like the Medicaid spend down, where if a person is a little over the amount to qualify, they can qualify by spending the number of dollars they are above the limit rather than getting no benefit at all? Barb in Wheatland says, using a sliding scale to determine what a family can afford to pay for childcare is the best avenue to take. It is so simple. Sliding scales are absolutely the answer. And in our last minute here, if you're hearing about $290 million in childcare block grant funds rolled over to the next year because they were unused, what happened briefly? What happened there, Pete?
Well, we had this thing called COVID-19 is the short answer. Prior to the pandemic, there were counties were kind of reporting that they were having a hard time spending all of their child care dollars. But we're talking like a couple million dollars in Monroe County. And now it's, you know, this past year, it was $14 million in Monroe County. And across the state, I mean, New York City has $190 million that they did not spend. A lot of families pulled their children from care during the pandemic. A lot of parents, particularly lower-income parents, lost work. A lot of child care programs closed or closed classrooms. And so the participation in these programs has been down. We're hoping to see that start to change because, you know, our economy needs to get going again. But it's a bit of an opportunity because we do have this excess funds now that's going to take some time to spend down. We can be more generous. We can expand eligibility. We can set up some more of these sliding scales that we're talking about, and we can help more families that need the support.
Where can people find the report from the Children's Agenda?
You can visit our website, thechildrensagenda.org, and it's right there on the front page.
I hope policymakers are reading, and I'm sure they are. I mean, I know you've got good relationships and you talk to them all the time. It's going to be an interesting year to see what happens there. By the way, listeners, if you want to jump on wherever you find your podcasts, Mom Me Timeout is what it's called. Danielle Jones, the head of the Mommy Timeout podcast, and it's designed to help moms just like her. Danielle, it's great stuff. Thanks for sharing your experience with us this hour.
Thank you so much.
And Pete Nabosny, policy director for the Children's Agenda. I know we'll talk soon. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks from the whole team here. Evan Dawson, Megan Mack, Rob Braden, Emma Ray Stein saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.